live from Burbank, California, where people's brains react differently than those in Tarzana. It's the Marc Maron Show. And now, he's still in love with Tom Cruise. Marc Maron!
There is no love lost between Tom and I after his failing at the box office and his insanity geniuses. Philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, need machines, of course, and godless U.S. soldier out there in Iraq, our singular Iraq vet dude listening out there in the desert daily on the podcast, wanted a shout out so his mommy could be proud of him for another reason. For listening to me, which I'm not sure how that would make somebody proud necessarily. But how are you, buddy? Thank you for listening. There it is, your special handcrafted shout out across the oceans there.
Do we
to
have
Iraq.
Any pictures of him?
I'm sure you can go on his site there. Yeah. He's got his own website and things. I would plug that, but I don't have it in my head right off the bat here. Today on the show, our friend David Poland's going to come in and talk to us about how Mission Impossible 3 failed at the box office, even though he said it wasn't going to. And also we've got, Dan Millman was supposed to come in. This is a guy that wrote The Way of the Peaceful Warrior. Now, I could have erased this whole event as if it hadn't happened, because this is a tape show. But I want to bring it up because we assumed that when he didn't get here that he was running late, or he had lost his way or taken the way of the Peaceful Warrior as opposed to the MapQuest directions. But these are those books. This is one of those incredibly popular books that everybody reads for guidance. It's like The Prophet or The Road Less Traveled or something. What's the other one someone threw at me? Is it called The Alchemist or something? Is that another one of them? Have you ever heard of that one, The Alchemist? Someone threw that at me. Like, you got to read this. Let me tell you something. I got to be honest with you. I've never been able to get through two pages of any of those kind of books. They always seem ridiculous to me, and they don't have any life lessons for me. I think I do okay, but clearly I have problems, as we noticed last week.
Yeah, you seem to adhere to their principles, these books. You kind of promulgate them.
What are you talking about?
Well, you're talking, you go through this whole introspective phases all the time, talking about being centered and
I don't think I've ever talked about being centered per
being
se. I am introspective, which enables me to be self-aware.
Yeah,
and if that frightens you a little bit, That, to me, says that you are unwilling to change, Jim. So if you think you are a perfect being...
I never say anything about myself, Mark.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. You are not introspective in the same way I am.
I just believe there's some things you shouldn't know about yourself because it's really too scary.
Well, exactly, and that type of fear is what has been a liability for you all these years.
I look upon it as a positive trait, something that's
denial,
like common sense, man.
Ignorance of you.
I don't want to know what I did on the 4th of July back in 1976 when I.
But do you want to know?
Woke up from a blackout, from a 3-day blackout.
Okay.
Why would I want to know what happened then?
But do you want to know why you did it? It's not a question
sure,
of...
Sure, I know why. I wanted to get laid.
And then the rest is just a mystery.
Yeah, it's a mystery.
It's in the black box of time.
Right.
Okay, I understand. I think that you've got problems that you're unwilling to face, and this is another indication of that. But you are right that you can take it too far, that self-awareness can go too far, that to the point where you're locked in your own head and you can't get out because you're so constantly self-reflecting. You're constantly self-aware, constantly self-conscious. And that's paralyzing. Believe me.
I think Freud is the one who said it best when he said sometimes a cigar is just like, not cocaine at all.
Yeah. And he also said, dude, can I use your credit card to chop this up? Did you know he said that?
I believe it.
Yeah. And they didn't even have credit cards then, which is really a testament to the forward thinking, the ability to see.
He was a visionary.
He was a visionary. But I'll tell you who's going to be on the show. We'll talk to Dan Millman about his book, and maybe he can show me the way of the peaceful warrior, because God knows that's what I need.
You need a Superman suit.
I need to be a piece
it says
of work.
Pee on it.
There's a lot of stuff going on in the world today, and I'll tell you, we're going to talk to our buddy over at Salon, Tim Grieve, about some of it. We've got Jessica Dene. Is that how you pronounce her name? I'm hoping Dene, the author of the Hot Mom's Handbook. I had a hot mom, and let me tell you something: liability, incredible paralysis. It was crippling to me to have a mom as hot as my mom was for my life. And continues to be.
Now, when your mom was hot, did you know she was hot?
Hell yeah. Did Hell it, yeah, I knew she was hot.
How did that affect you? Did it affect you in any adverse manner?
Listen, Dr. Freud, Mr. I don't want to deal with my own problems poking around in my psyche. Yeah, it had a tremendous adverse effect, and it continues to have an effect.
You have a lot of your friends coming over just to be with your mom?
Yeah, absolutely, and she'd flirt with them. That was horrendous. And to this day, I am unable to say my mother is anything older than 37. I've been disallowed. I've been forbidden, is what I'm looking for, to say my age publicly because of the implications it would have on my mother and her sense of vanity. It's paralyzing, and I hope that Jessica Denae has got a different approach than the one my mom took, which was using me as her pain sponge because my father was not available, and then cutting me loose. My mother, literally, listen
wait,
to me.
Wait, can we...
What?
Clip that for a quip, a clip?
Yeah. Do you want to stop the show to do it? Or do you want to keep moving forward?
That's like something, you know,
I'm using
court cases are made out of.
Oh, no. I've grown to love my mother. She's a character. That's what happens if you're lucky is if you didn't really like your parents a lot or that you felt that you were emotionally abused by them throughout your life, is that the best thing that can happen is eventually you go, there, she's a character. She's wacky. You know, and of course, outside of that, to say that, you know, I truly love my parents, that's a long shot. But to say they're characters.
I met your mom.
Yeah, she's a character, right?
Yeah, and besides that.
She's hot, huh? Yeah, still has it. Yeah. Hey, look, folks, a lot happened in the news today, and we want to make sure you're up to speed, not caught off guard. So here's the first edition of Mark Maron Show's Short Order News. In his speech to the nation tonight, President Bush proposed using thousands of National Guard troops to patrol the Mexican border. The president anticipates an onslaught of border activity after word was spread on a Mexican internet site known as MySpace. Come on, really? I love it. During his graduation speech at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, Senator John McCain essentially apologized for denouncing the Christian fundamentalists as evil 6 years ago. McCain entitled his speech, Even Jesus Had Flip-Flops. But they were sandals, you know, they were sandals, Andy, and I'm explaining it to the guy behind the glass booth, who is, I think, listening to a Rush album right now. A woman in Idaho discovered a heart-shaped potato. The woman later divulged that the heart-shaped potato had a knife in it, along with a note from a former boyfriend that read, I'm watching you, Linda. And those are the short order news for tonight. I was in Vegas, man. Are we going to hold that? Are we going to save that for later, the Vegas discussion?
Hell, why not?
I spoke truth to partiers.
I thought you looked forward to going to Vegas.
I spoke truth to partiers. I looked forward to spending a weekend with my wife, and we did have a nice time. But Vegas, no matter, it's just a lot of glitz covering there's a fine line in Vegas between saying, hey, man, Vegas, and saying, I'm in trouble, man. I'm in a little trouble, all right? I think the chick in the room is dead, and I don't have any more money, and I don't know what to do. It's just a stone's throw away.
I just don't think there are any positive things about Las Vegas.
Of course you
at
don't.
All.
Of course you don't. I mean, why would you? Look at you.
There's nothing. What do you do there? It's just the sole purpose is to waste water, pollute, and to steal people's money, and that's it.
Oh, man. Jim Buzzkill Earl.
Hey, you know.
On the mic.
You ever been to the outskirts of Vegas?
What?
It's called nature. Nature, Mark.
Yeah, I like it. I love the desert. You're talking the wrong guy. I'm not a Vegas fan.
Horned toads, turtles.
But I did engage in the Vegas behavior. I don't like Vegas. Never have. Haven't been there in 15 years. Don't like gambling. Makes me feel bad. But the deal was, I was there to entertain because I'm a comedian. And I'm not a big sourpuss. I believe that everybody can be changed a little bit, even if the setting is Vegas. Had a good show.
What was the average age of your audience?
The average age of the audience was very mixed. It was an interesting audience. It was about 200 people. It was in the lounge at the Palms.
Were they gambling there? In the lounge while your
No. It was nice. It was a stage. It was sponsored by Playboy, so there was a playmate there. My wife opened for me. And believe me, all this stuff to me is ridiculous. But I learned something about humanity. I saw people. It's sad. You know, even when we talk about a surveillance society, which is a big issue now with the National Security Agency, is that, you know, you're in Vegas and that is a surveillance society. You can't even use your payphone at a blackjack table. You can't, you know, you have to do your hands a certain way. You are being looked at more than anywhere else in the world, so you're not cheating.
Where do you think the NSA gets their technology from?
Yeah, exactly. Why they take your money. There is no winning. I learned a few things about myself. I learned a few things about myself in terms of gambling, in terms of how I see myself. You want to know what I learned about myself in Vegas?
What?
I'll tell you in a second. You're listening to the Mark Maron Show. We'll be back with Tim Grieve. And anger management, I'm looking into it. It's going to happen. Okay? All right. Stay there.
And now he's securing our borders with beeswax and orange crates. Mark Maron.
That's right, Jim. You know what I learned in Vegas? I'll tell you what I learned. That I am not a victim. That's what I learned, man.
Oh, man, I'm glad to learn something.
I'll explain that to you later.
I look forward to that.
Nobody wins there, dude. Nobody wins there. I don't know why it took me so long to realize that.
The man wins there.
Okay. To use that in a general way, yes, the man does win there. Tim Grieve, my friend, stays on top of the news, but he also stays on top of his column. He posts sometimes 2-3 times a day. That's what's great about the age of the internet. If you need to get something out there now, you can. Tim's column is The War Room. On Salon.com, he's back with us on the phone to crunch some news. Welcome back to the show, Tim Grieve.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm good, man. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being on the phone for coming.
thanks for being you.
Yeah, well, thank you. You too, as well. This is going well so far. This is great. Look,
we ought to do a White House press briefing, man.
Yeah, it sounds exactly like this, except I can't give you any more information. All right, look, so by the time this airs, Bush will have announced that he's going to put National Guard troops on the border of Mexico. Now, it seems to me that there is a... he wants to have it both ways, that he wants to pander to a sort of, racist, kind of isolationist mentality that feel threatened, maybe rightfully so, maybe not, by the Mexican illegals. But it seems that on the other side of that, he also wants to basically lock the illegals that are here in and create a program that'll work for them.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, he needs it both ways. He needs sort of big business to be happy with him to stay on, you know, guest worker program and all that sort of stuff. But the man's got nothing left than his base, other than his base, and he doesn't seem to have much of that anymore. And he's got to do something to suck those people back onto his side. And what better way than to sort of both invoke the military and invoke it to keep those people on the other side of the border?
Pander to hate and fear.
This is what we do here.
All right, so let's talk about the NSA wiretapping, the wiretapping of everyone policy. All right, first. I was looking at your column. There were some polls released that were completely a little short sighted in the sense that they were taken before this stuff really blew up, and then we have other polls that indicate what?
Yeah, the first poll out of the gate was this Washington Post poll. Literally the day the story broke about the wiretap, it said something like 65% or 70% of the American public was in support of it, or not the wiretap, but the monitoring of calls.
Sure.
The new polls that were taken over the weekend after I had a chance to seek in a little says a majority opposes it, 53%, I think, in one, 55 in another, numbers right around there. And more interesting, I thought, something like 60-65% of the public says, hey, this is something that Congress ought to investigate now, which tells me that, you know, once people have a little time to think about this, they're really not okay with it.
Of course.
If the administration thinks they're going to be, I think they've got another thing coming.
And it's so striking to me, Tim, is that you've got an administration that is probably among the most secret in history, who are amassing data on such huge numbers of people that the hypocrisy and the sort of weird totalitarian implications of it couldn't be more clear to me.
Yeah, I'd like to make let's make a deal. I'll let Dick Cheney look at all my phone records if I get to look at all of his.
I think that's reasonable. I personally think, and I may be crazy here because I know this was bandied about before, but I think there is a chance that Cheney's going to resign.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a little bit about this today. You know, his fingerprints are getting darker and darker on the Valerie Plame case. You know, he's the guy who is apparently advocating NSA programs that are beyond what Bush approved.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, he has no sort of base of popularity left in the country. I guess it wouldn't shock me that after the elections he steps aside, but I guess I wouldn't be surprised if he stays either. I mean, these people are about ego, about not admitting failure. And it's pretty late in the day for them to change their stripes and that kind of stuff.
Well, let's get back just for a minute about the NSA stuff. Is that you've reported that a couple of reporters have pretty good indication and evidence that their calls are being monitored, specifically, you know, not for national security reasons, but perhaps to trace who their informers are and who their confidential sources are. Where did you find that story, and what is that about?
Yeah, a couple of ABC reporters who have done reporting on the CIA secret prisons and other sort of things that get the Bush administration's goat, have apparently been told by what they call a senior law enforcement official that the government is tracking their phone lines, and I guess this official told them it's time for them to get some new cell phones and to do it quickly. So, you know, they don't know whether this tracking is part of this NSA program or if it's part of a more specific investigation into the leaks on the CIA stuff. But boy, if you need a quick reminder that Big Brother is here, I guess that provides it for you.
Yeah. Isn't this the kind of thing that happens in almost every administration, though, at one point or another? Nixon, didn't he use the FBI and CIA to monitor leaks in the White House?
Yeah, I mean, if Nixon plus Bush equals every administration,
yeah. Well, you don't know of any other occurrences in any other administration besides Republican administration.
No, I think I can't remember the details, but I know there was some story about the Clinton administration getting FBI files on people. But you know, has any other administration had a program where they're trying to and apparently succeeding? Tracking the phone calls of every American?
No. And I think the importance is that, like, you know, there's such a stunning difference between the idea of selling this idea that they're protecting the country, whereas really they're doing everything they can to insulate and protect themselves and maintain power.
Well, yeah, I just don't get the argument that this NSA database protects the country. I mean, if what they're saying is we need to track calls where they're suspected terrorists on one end of the line or not, you go to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court and you get a warrant to do that.
You can even
do it before you get a warrant and then go get one afterwards. So what additional information do you get from having a list of everybody's phone calls? I don't get it.
I don't either. I keep picturing, like, I just now pictured actually this idea, the scene from Beautiful Mind where Russell Crowe is just standing there looking at numbers, and I imagine that their paranoid idea was to disconnect series of calls from one number to another number, but it just seems ridiculous, and it seems that it's more of a propaganda tool just to frighten everybody into submission.
Well, right, and if you don't know the sort of predicate information that you know one of those numbers is a terrorist suspect's number, then what are you going to do with that information? And if you do know that, then you can go get a warrant to trace all the calls to and from that number. So it just doesn't make sense.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, and I just think that the overall, and as I've written about this, the overall scary thing about this is in the good old days before 2000, before the attacks of 9/11, the government didn't have this information, and if it needed the information, it had to ask for it. It had to get a court's permission. So we knew that a political operative, say in the Bush administration, couldn't go over the NSA and say, "Hey, let me check out your files."
Right. We got it. Let's
now
take.
Now we just don't know.
Yeah. Let's take a break, Tim. There's also indication that they did know something about the attack. So stay with us. We're going to finish up with Rove in a second, and Tim Grieve is with us.
And now he's the decider and the uniter. He's the decide-uniter, Mark Maron.
I learned that I wasn't a victim, but I was still a sucker. That's what I learned in Vegas. We're on the phone with Tim Grieve, Salon.com columnist. His column, The War Room, is where to go. You can go to it at markmaron.com and link right up to it. We're talking about this amassing data of everybody's phone interactions. Well, there is some indication that General Michael Hayden might have intercepted a phone call, an actual Al-Qaeda phone call, saying we're going to attack the World Trade Center, that this is it, and they didn't translate it in time.
Yeah, I mean... What good is getting all this information if you're not going to do anything with it? And if they now have the world's largest database, as they say, I guess that doesn't provide me a lot of comfort that they're figuring out anything smart from
it. It's sort of like buying a lot of books you don't read. When somebody comes over, you look smart to them until you tell them, like, yeah, I don't really read them.
But I've gotten rid of the books, and I just keep my laptop on the desk and pretend I know everything that's inside.
Exactly. And it just serves a different purpose. It's like, we know everything about you. So everybody freaked out. It is Big Brother. So let's talk about Karl Rove a little bit. I read Jason Leopold over at Truth Out. I read Larissa Alexandrovna Ross' story. And I was led to believe, once again, that Rove will be indicted today or tomorrow. And, you know, he's out there yesterday, talking it up. Or was that this morning where he had the press conference over at wherever the hell he was at the Republican think tank, where he's just saying,
Roe, yeah.
Yeah, that was this morning, and he's just sort of like, everything's good, I feel all right, you know, I'm not in trouble. Now, where the hell is this information coming from? Who's why and who isn't? Is he going to be indicted already? I want some satisfaction.
Don't we all? I mean, God knows. Jason Leopold reported, as you said, on, I guess, on Friday, Saturday, you know, a story in which he claimed sources were telling him all sorts of things about a 15-hour meeting that Patrick Fitzgerald had with Rove and his lawyers on Friday. And, you know, Rove's spokesman says, you know, categorically, didn't happen, they didn't meet, they didn't have any communication, completely untrue. And you're right, Rove seemed like he was in good humor this morning. He was asked about his involvement in the case, and he brushed it off and said, nice try. So, you know, God knows, and he's not telling, I guess.
Oh, man, that's so disappointing. Now, let's jump over to the CIA here. The slowly disintegrating CIA, Porter Goss, the head of the CIA, resigns a day after his third in command, Dusty Fogo, because of implications that Fogo is definitely in cahoots with this arms defense contractor, Wilkes. In these parties where they were attempting to buy legislation and broker defense contracts through power schmoozing with hookers and poker. But I got a weird...
Other than that.
Other than that, everything's cool. But I got a weird thought, because I read a piece on the CIA diminishing in the New York Times, and we know that there is a bit of politicking and a war between John Negroponte, the Homeland Security czar, and Rumsfeld over there in the Pentagon. Now, do you think that any of this could be being facilitated on some level by the Pentagon to sink the agency?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the Pentagon and Cheney, too, you know, sort of want their own sources of intelligence, because they didn't like the answers they were getting from the CIA on Iraq, and because they, you know, they want that power more generally. So would that surprise me? Not at all. You know, we're also learning today in a Newsweek report that people in the administration apparently were pretty unhappy with Goss with respect to Fogo. And had been urging him to can Fogo. When he didn't do that, that was sort of one more knock in their confidence on him. So it increasingly seems like there were a whole lot of things that they were concerned about Goss. I continue to suspect that the Fogo related stuff is the straw that broke the camel's back. But it
seems to me like all this stuff between Negroponte and Rumsfeld is really diminishing any sort of sense that they're doing anything for national security. Once again, they are just trying to guarantee their agency's power and to guarantee their agency, the Pentagon's agency, for the money. And it just, what is the CIA going to be? It's just going to be this building where all these phone numbers are being stored.
That's right. And you know, and out of the role of analyzing intelligence, which is what the CIA was supposed to be in the first place.
And it's interesting that the reason that I didn't realize this until I read this piece, that the reason that the CIA was to be a civilian organization was literally to check the Pentagon's power when it came to decisions that they would make about war and intelligence that would lead them into war.
Right, exactly. And now if things go according to plan, we'll have an Air Force general in charge of the CIA. So that plan worked out pretty well.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, this has been enlightening. Thanks for talking to us, Tim. It's great to talk to you.
Always a pleasure.
You take care. Tim Grieve, Salon.com columnist. The War Room is the name of the column. Did you know that? I found that to be a fascinating article, that the CIA, the reason why it was a civilian operation was essentially to stop from happening what happened. It was essentially there to be a check, to check the government, to check the military from just taking information, amplifying it, or putting it over the top.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly during the Cold War, where it's like, the Russians have a million bombs. The CIA needed to sort of be there and say, well, you know, it's not a million, and there's no reason for us to get into a war. I think, and this is the other issue about analysts, too, is that these guys who are CIA analysts would speculate based on information. They'd project. They'd go long-term, and they'd say, look, here's what's going on in Iraq. Here's what they could do. Here's what could happen. Here's what we have now. So let's talk about this. Let's make some assessments based on our intelligence. Whereas now, apparently, the culture all changed because the administration – or the military, whichever administration was in power, because of the pace that information works at now, needed it quickly. So there was not the analyst's role became marginalized because they just needed information that would accommodate policy immediately. So guys like Ray McGovern, the guy who spoke up against Rumsfeld and asked him some very specific questions that would have been asked by an analyst had they been given the opportunity leading up to the Iraq War, and if the analyst still had the place in the agency that it once once had, and that information was respected, and that analysis was respected, we would have been able to stop the military from making decisions with the neocon death cult in executing this ideology gone haywire in Iraq. But that was, the agency was already gutted, and Tenet was already selling it out, and they were being bullied for information that fit their ideology. So that's interesting to know, is that what once was. And the other thing that struck me is that the CIA has always, we've always been critical of the CIA, as we should. Covert operations and some of the stuff they were involved in South America and Cuba, and in terms of hijacking legitimate governments and helping death squads and whatnot. Questionable stuff, horrendous stuff. CIA, not always the good guy, but the intent was to actually act as a check on the military. And now it's gutted, and now it very well may just become a sort of barely functioning appendage of the government that supports the military information, the DIA, the Department of the Defense Intelligence Agency. It's very frightening stuff. It's frightening when you start to look at the CIA, a historical bad guy, certainly from the 60s and certainly, in terms of what they've done, as some sort of underdog that needs support. It's like, hey, man, help out the CIA. But there were guys in there, like Bob Baer, like this guy Ray McGovern. There were guys that were actually doing stuff for national security, actually keeping a pulse on the ebbs and flows of terrorism and renegade regimes in the world in order to provide information that would protect the country, as opposed to facilitate preemptive strikes or non-provoked strikes on countries and just let the military-industrial complex take over, which was Eisenhower's big fear. So hopefully, I don't know where it's all going, Jim. I don't know where it's all going. But
I think it's getting better.
I do know that people are listening to our conversation right now, which makes me frightened. You know what I mean?
I hope people are keeping track of all my telephone calls as well, because somebody should. I can't keep track of all that stuff. I'm glad there's somebody out there keeping track of it for me. I know this may sound nutty, and out there.
Yeah.
But I'm of that position. I look at for the full half of water. I want to look at the positive side of things, and I think that maybe there's some good that'll come out of all of this.
You're confusing me.
No, seriously. I think it's a good thing. What? Do you know who you call every week?
Yeah, I just got to look at my phone bill. They have a phone bill. The phone bill will provide that to you. The phone company already does what you're saying.
Oh. Yeah, but sometimes, you don't get that. Sometimes somebody, if you have a rogue next door neighbor who takes your mail out of your mailbox.
Well, these are different problems.
Maybe a squirrel comes in there and just kind of takes my letters and stuff.
I hear you. No, I don't think it's good. And I don't, the thing that frightens me the most is what we were talking about before and what I think you've talked about and hit on with some of the stuff that you've enjoyed talking about, which is that a surveillance-based society where the propaganda is that we've got everyone's phone number, we know what everyone's doing, and once people start to accept that and they become submissive, this attitude is like, well, I have nothing to hide. Everyone has something to hide because no one knows how that technology is going to be used. The idea that they are monitoring for terrorism is besides the point. It really comes down to privacy. It comes down to our constitutional rights of privacy.
To see who's leaking at the White House. That's what that seems like one of their major concerns. They can't possibly get anything from millions and millions of phone records.
Yeah, but they can focus on links, and depending on what they want to look at you for, what the particular point is now, whatever they're looking at now, whether it's terrorists or pornographers or pedophiles, it could be for any reason.
If I were the White House,
for any reason,
the first thing I'd do with all those phone records would be to concentrate on ABC, NBC, CNN, and Washington Post, and see who they're calling, who they're talking to.
I just think that it transgresses transgresses the Constitution. Leaks aside,
of course
that
may
be a very good point. But once this stuff is out there, once people the frame is set that we're all being watched, it diminishes our ability to really have a sense of constitutional freedom.
It diminishes our ability to get it back again. Those civil rights.
That's even more frightening.
But the thing is, if that polls 51% against it. You know, what if next week we have another attack? What's going to happen to those poll numbers? You know, is this country? I don't trust this country.
But still, what the hell has it got to do with the phone calls? If we have another attack anybody next week, it's on this guy's watch, and it can only indicate that they are not doing their job.
Really? But you think the public's going to think, I don't have that much faith in people. I think people are going to panic first, and they're going to go back to their old ways when Bush had a huge popularity level.
I can't do that. It's like Tom Hartman. I heard Tom Hartman talking about this, about an October surprise, and I'm the first guy that will think in those terms. I am the first guy that will think, like, this administration is going to let something happen to initiate all that fear again and take power. You know, but I don't know how that's different from using 9/11. Yeah, I don't know how that's different from in saying that, you know, with the right wing to use 9/11 to facilitate. Us sitting here saying, like, you know, hey, they're going to blow something up. They're going to let it happen. I don't know how that's not engaging in the same sort of dynamic. I don't know.
Well, I'm saying if it happens.
No, I understand. You know,
if it happens.
That. I just kind of went off on my own thing. We'll be back in a minute. We've got Jessica Dene, author of The Hot Mom's Handbook. We need a break.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and David Poland's going to be in here from thehotbutton.com and Movie City News to talk movies, and the National Guard is going to the border.
And now he'll help you enroll in Medicare. Mark Maron.
So if those people are going to need help. Did you read that Paul Krugman thing?
No, I didn't, but they're going to need help anyway.
Well, it's unclear how they're supposed to re-up or whether they're going to be involved.
It's horribly confusing.
What are they doing that to the old people for?
Because they're easily confused.
These people are just evil, and I've always known it, and it's only going to get more evil. Can I tell you a little bit more about Evil Vegas? And I want to hear a little bit of your talk about this environmental issue.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was in Vegas. I did some shows. There were good times. And the reason I realized I wasn't a victim is for some reason when I'm in Vegas, I always make the assumption, like, I don't get cards. I got bad luck. Where are my blackjacks? How come I'm not winning? Because you know what? The people that actually leave there with money, it's infinitesimal. And very few people win. I'm not the only ass who doesn't win. Nobody wins there. No, everyone's walking around pretending to have a good time, pretending like they're okay with losing money. It's ridiculous.
They're all zombies.
Well, I don't know if they're zombies. It's a very compulsive behavior. When you sit down, okay, you lose a chunk of money, and then you take some more money out. The best thing you can do, if you're going to go ahead and waste that money, is not think that you're going to win the other stuff back. Just look at it as a whole new chunk of change and start playing. If you're not enjoying the thrill, the roller coaster ride of possibly winning money and losing money, and that weird ampy kind of drugged out feeling you get when you're you know when you're you know putting like everything you got on the line, man. You know what I'm saying?
I always set myself a limit, like $7,000, $8,000.
What are you, some sort of wuss? And come on, live it.
If I go over that, then you know I have to go back to the hotel room and get some more money.
You got to put it all on the line, man. I got the bank closing in on my house now.
Let me tell you about my story of Reno, Nevada, 1969.
Yeah.
We went to see Gomer Pyle sing in one of the lounges. He wasn't there, though. Roger Miller replaced him.
Are you serious?
Yeah. So we sat in the front row. I was like 8 or 9. And I had to go up and get, use the bathroom. And I come back, and he just ridicules me. He makes horrible fun of me.
And that's why he became a comic. You should thank him. That's probably why. I had the similar experience with Jackie Vernon. My grandparents, we used to meet my grandfolks out in Vegas occasionally, and I'd go see shows with them. And my grandmother was always funny, and this was back in the 70s when the MGM Grand was just built, and my grandmother always used to say about Vegas, it was nicer when the boys ran things, when it was like just the downtown. We went downtown, and there's definitely a difference between the Strip and downtown. The Strip is for tourist suckers who just want to dump money into nothing, and downtown is for real, horrendous gamblers with problems, like just degenerate gambler types. But ultimately, the most interesting thing I found about it was that I realized I'm just a sucker, not a victim, and I realized that I'm in show business because my name was huge. It was like in truck-sized letters out in front of the Palms. And then who came over after the show? Doug Benson and Dan Gabriel. You know Dan Gabriel?
Oh, yeah.
They were opening for Slayton down at the Riviera.
Obviously.
Yeah. So they came by. And then it really started to have that kind of feel, that old-school Vegas feel where it's sort of like, where are you guys working? It was kind of like a bunch of comics hanging out. Because Vegas is a show business outlet, and that's what it is. It's like where people in show business go to work. The same weekend I was there, Leno was there working somewhere. Seinfeld was there. Howie Mandel was there. George Wallace was there. Bobby Slayton was at another hotel. I was actually proud, even though the sign was much bigger than the gig itself. I was actually proud to have my name up on the strip. It was very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of had that thrill, too, like 15 years ago when I took a Polaroid of our gig at a Holiday Inn.
Yeah.
Lank and
sure.
Earl.
Yeah.
Right underneath, you know, knife
buffet.
And fork room buffet.
Yeah, I love it.
That's a great thrill. I still have that picture. Thanks for bringing that up, making me feel small again.
Whoa.
That's okay.
One time I remember going doing a hotel gig, and there was like a list of things that happened. You know, it's like Monday night, country western. Tuesday night, disco. Wednesday night, free food and comedy. We're like second to the buffet. We did have some good dinner there. Hey, look, here's another thing I wanted to say about the. We've got some great guests in this week coming up. We got Lewis Black tomorrow. We got Nancy Northrup from the Center for Reproductive Rights to talk about the future of abortion legislation. We've got Jack Boulware tomorrow as well. But we got Michelle Goldberg later in the week, who's going to talk about her book, Kingdom Coming. Which is about this rise of Christian fascism in this country. And I think do yourself a favor. If you want to really see what any theocracy will eventually become, whether, you know, give or take polygamy, give or take a wife or two. But the articles that are being that was in the L.A. Times over the weekend, A Blind Eye to Culture of Abuse, about these fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormon compounds, is that is really a functioning theocracy. And there is no way that theocracy can look any different than that, in the sense that the way it creates a submissive population, the way that it completely denies women their rights.
You're talking about the Taliban in southwest Utah?
Yeah. I don't know if their laws are like the Taliban, but in terms of what it does to facilitate abuse of young people, of women, of the laws of the land, that there is nothing, there is no way that no matter how extreme, how extremely charming or charismatic or even mainstream some of this Christianity, some of this movement towards theocracy may seem, there, it's always going to look like this underneath. There's always going to be corruption. There's going to be people that want to repress people's rights and take advantage of the innocent.
You know, the thing that struck me about that story was what? That the one thing that is stronger than, you know, the desire for their so-called beliefs and religious beliefs is the desire for money. And you have the story of these people running around with hordes of money after they steal it from the church and try to set up more churches throughout the country. Like that Jeffs guy, Warren Jeffs, I think.
Yeah, but what about the desire to exploit women and children? Well, that is a sad thing. And just the weird...
Yeah, you get a lot of money from that, I guess. You know, you have men in charge of, you know, hordes of women. They have like three or four wives.
But the way that they throw away young men, they will literally, they'll push the younger guys out of the community, out onto the street when they're like 10, so they will protect their resource of women. It's pretty sick stuff, and I don't think it can ever look any different than that. I will come back. We're going to have David Poland in here to talk about movies. We're going to have Jessica Dene here in a minute to talk about the Hot Moms Handbook. Stay with us.
And now he's restoring diplomatic ties with his tailor, Mark Maron.
What does that even mean? I am tired of asking. I'm tired of thinking about it, whatever the hell comes out of you.
It's a huge puzzle. It's a word puzzle.
Your weird head. All right, I'm done with it. Look, I have to be honest with you. I am the product of a hot mom, as I discussed earlier in the show. My mother was and is completely consumed with her personal appearance and herself, but that is a different type of hot mom than we're going to be talking about in a minute. She refuses to let me say how old she is in public because it will make her feel old. So my experience with a hot mom was a little difficult. My mom was not an empowered hot mom like Jessica Dene. Am I saying it right?
Yep.
Oh, good. Who decided to try to redefine the traditional image of motherhood by helping other moms find confidence and community through resources that are available on HMCmagazine.com. And Jessica's new book, The Hot Mom's Handbook. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Did you have a happy Mother's Day?
I had a great Mother's Day.
So now let's talk about the definition of the word hot. We're kind of broadening that definition here, aren't we?
Absolutely. We define it as confident and empowered. It refers to moms of all ages, all shapes and sizes. Mm-hmm. It's an attitude. It's a way of being.
So it's not just like, hey, she's hot. Is that But, I mean, well, let's be honest. There is a, so hot is basically, it's different than the MILF idea, but it does encompass MILFism as well.
Well, sure. You know, we do PG MILF.
Okay.
clean MILF.
Yeah.
Basically, we do want to prove that being a mom and being sexy isn't mutually exclusive. You know,
okay.
We want to bring the sexiness back into motherhood, but it has to come from the inside out.
Okay.
You know, it's once you feel good on the inside, you want to reflect that on the outside.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's you got to be careful. Because like I said, I grew up with my mom was really pretty, and she put a lot of time into it. Literally, I do not know what my mom's hair color really is to this day. And she was always stunning and very flirty and out there. But I don't think that she was empowered from the inside. What are some of the ways you go about giving that to a woman who? Because I guess motherhood can be very daunting for a lot of people.
It's you know it's so easy to get consumed mm-hmm. in like the madness of motherhood. I was there. You know, I was one of those moms who, you know, wore the same outfit 3 days in a row. You know, I'd sniff it from the hamper and put it right on because it was easy and it was comfortable. And I thought to be a good mom or to be the best mom, my world had to revolve around my son.
Mm-hmm.
But what I didn't realize is, you know, in order to be the best mom, you have to be the best you.
Right.
And I let myself go,
uh-huh.
you know, like in all ways, in uh-huh. my spirit and doing anything I wanted to into mothering.
Sure.
And like I said, that's why we decided, you know what, motherhood needs to be redefined. People used to say to me all the time, you know, you don't look like a mom.
Yeah.
And I used to think, well, what does a mom look like?
Uh-huh.
Why do we have this image of what a mom is or the stereotype of what a good mom should be?
Sure.
So,
what were some of those points of redefining? What are some of the old traditional ideas of motherhood that you thought needed to be sort of hot-rodded?
Yeah, well, the first one is that, like I said, your world has to revolve around your kids.
Right.
Honestly, motherhood should broaden and expand you. You're not merely just a mom. You're a mom in addition to all the other amazing things you are, and it's so important not to forget that.
Yeah, and not to forget the kid, though, too. That's
exactly.
The trick.
Exactly. I mean, there's balance. It's all about balance. We're just saying, yeah. You know, we're not saying put yourself on the top of the to-do list, but just make sure you're on the to-do list. So often as moms, we do everything for everybody else all day long but ourselves. And you know what? When you do that, you become resentful. You know, you have to you know, be centered and balanced. I say it makes you a better mom when you go and you do a few things for yourself because you're refreshed. You're happier.
Yeah, so you don't find yourself saying this to your kid. What do you need? What is it? What's the problem?
Exactly.
What's with the tears? You got problems. Anyway, see, I'm going back to my childhood. Anyways, it wasn't that bad. Now, what about, I like the way you have, there's in the book, The Hot Mom's Handbook, you have some room for journaling. You have room. There's some questions that you can have women answer. And I guess this really serves as a reminder because I think it's really hard to forget a lot of the stuff that you're talking about when you're consumed with kids.
Exactly. And this whole book is really just that gentle reminder of everything we already know as women, but we forget once we become moms.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times there's so much guilt placed on mothers, like when you want to do anything for yourself. Like, for example, just maybe like once a week, whether it's take a class, go meet your girlfriends for coffee, or get your nails done. Like, moms were made to feel guilty if they weren't spending every minute with their children.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying go and, you know, but you should do that once in a while. Do things for you. It makes you feel better. I argue it makes you a better mom.
Yeah, my parents used to use the we can't wait for summer camp thing, sleepover camp, anything to get them out of the house for at least 2 weeks. It's just great. Send them off to, do you suggest that in the book? If the grandparents are out of town, give them a trip for 3 weeks to the
Exactly. You know, it's like I said, you have to still live your life. And,
yeah.
You know, honestly, by having a life outside your kids, you're teaching them and giving them the confidence to have a life outside of you.
Okay. Now, let's go over. There's a couple of chapters that address certain things, and maybe we can explain them a little bit. And you can also link to, if you go to markmaron.com, there is a link to the Hot Mom's handbook, and there's also a link. Tell me a little bit about the magazine page. The site that you guys have put together.
Oh, yeah. It's hotmomsclub.com or hmcmagazine.com.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a an informational, emotional, inspirational resource for moms. It was started by moms. It's run and written by moms, and it's for moms. And it's we've got, you know, celebrity mom interviews. We have moms that rock. It's just moms that are out there doing these amazing things. Hot mompreneurs, mom running own businesses. You name it, everything. Like what's hot mom products. It's cool, you know. And we have like Ask the Man, and you know.
Is there a link to neglectedchildren.com?
No.
I'm sorry.
Our whole thing is this makes you, you're doing this for the sake of your children, so you're a better mom.
Sure. I actually think it is very important because I think that one of the things that gets damaged when women start to raise kids is their sense of who they are.
Yep.
And I think that needs to be addressed a lot because I notice that just with friends where, you know, people my age, a lot of my friends have started having kids and some of them have had them for a while. Mm-hmm. And there's that weird period where the wife will, what, you got your phone? That's okay. That happens sometimes. is it still ringing? Don't worry. It's a liability of the modern world. But a lot of times they get lost in this thing. And like you said, they get exhausted. They stop caring about themselves. They're like cats that you have to be concerned of that you might need to go to the vet. But let's talk about Every Mom Has an Inner Siren. That's the name of a chapter. What does that mean?
Absolutely. It's remembering that, you know what, guess what? You're still a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And you can still be sexy after you've had kids. You know, it's so hard today to keep a healthy self-image even before your body's been, like, shaped, like, kicked and pushed and pulled from the inside. So mm-hmm. as moms and as women, it's, you know, you have to remember that you are still a sexy woman. And this chapter is all about kind of, you know, helping you remember that. I say wear, you know, those wear a pair of sexy panties to your next PTA meeting just for fun. No one has to know but you. It'll remind you that you're still feminine. And
I would wear other things with the outfit, too, because then you'd be
weird. Exactly.
Then you'd be the neighborhood freak. Then.
Yeah.
What else? What are some other suggestions?
You know, let's see. I say, you know, find something every day, like find whether it's like a cool statue, something that's sexy, something that reminds you, you know, whether it's like red lipstick or something, and keep it visible to you every day so you see it or put on a little red lipstick, something that reminds you, you know, I'm still a woman, I'm still feminine, even though you're, you know, running around doing errands all day.
Sure. Now where do men play into this? Because, I don't know. Are you married or no?
I'm a single mom.
Okay.
I was married at one time. But men love this. This is great. Men are loving this. And actually, on our site, because we sell different products like Hot Mom products, I would say majority of our sales are to men buying them as gifts.
Oh,
and guys love this because, let's face it, what man doesn't want their woman to feel confident and good about themselves? And we support nurturing your relationships.
Uh-huh.
You know, we say that's important. Like, make playtime with your man, whether it's your husband or your boyfriend, because honestly, who's modeling relationships but you to your children? So
sure.
If you neglect your husband for your kids, then what is that really teaching them or showing them?
Yeah, and I think that I find that when you do that, you'll actually see your husband turn into more of a child.
Yeah, exactly.
Why not me?
Exactly.
So you actually have gift options for, that's a good idea, because men never know what the hell to get
women.
Yeah,
we've got our little Hot Moms Club t-shirts, and
we have
shirts for kids that say, I've got a hot mom, and my mom's hotter than your mom, and my wife's a hot mom, you know, everything. And people love it. They love it. It's really fun.
I wonder what's going to happen to these kids. Because I'm telling you, I know what it's like to have a hot mom. And the one benefit of it is that they will appreciate hot women. That is one thing your son will grow up to appreciate hot moms in the future.
Well, now, I hope that my son would appreciate women who are, like, independent and confident and people who follow, you know, they pursue what they want to do in their life.
Well, I think that's very important. Now, are you going to tour with the book? Are you going places? Do you do seminars yet?
Yeah, well, I just got back from New York and I did a bunch of shows out there, and the book's doing really well.
Uh-huh.
And we've got big plans. I'm actually going in Canada. They really love this in Canada, so I'm heading to Toronto to do some shows out there as well. And
a show? Now you call it a show. Now what's part of the show?
Different television shows.
Oh, okay, okay.
Radio shows, things like that.
You actually had a presentation where you, like, opened up curtains and there was, like, a bunch of hot moms doing different...
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I bet people would want that.
You're on a tour bus with a bunch of hot moms and kids and, yeah.
Exactly. I'm sure there's a lot of disappointed guys who come onto our site, hotmomsclub.com, thinking, you know, oh, this is exactly what I had in mind.
I was one of them. Why do you think you're a guest? I said, I better go to the right site. I think it's great what you're doing. And, as I said, you can go to HMCmagazine.com and see what they're doing. If you are a mom and this sounds attractive to you, if you're a man, clearly you can find some gift choices. The book is The Hot Mom's Handbook. And happy Mother's Day.
Thank you so
and
much.
And good luck with everything. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
And now he's blocking the absorption of damaging proteins. Mark Maron.
So that's a good thing, right?
Yes, it is.
Oh, thank God.
Very positive.
So, Jim, well, you know, what the hell did you do this weekend?
I was researching biodiesel some more.
That's it?
Trying to buy a cheap Mercedes diesel and convert it for $500-$600 to cooking oil.
Man, I don't know.
Cooking oil, you know, that's much cheaper than gas, obviously. And you could go to Costco, get a gallon for about $2 or so, $2.60.
And you can get
it for free at McDonald's or your Chinese restaurant or the donut store.
So you're going to go develop a relationship with all these local businesses as the guy that takes the dirty grease, and you're going to, you know, with your significant other, Heather, you're going to load up the truck with vats of dirty, crappy Friolator grease.
Yeah.
And go to your house where you've got some junked up, you know, 1972 Mercedes diesel nightmare.
83, probably.
And you're going to start filling it up. You guys are going to be covered with the smell of crappy old Chinese food and French fries, and you're going to be driving to wherever you're going, maybe the Goodwill to pick up. I mean, what the hell sounds so good. Huh?
What's wrong with that?
It's great, you self-righteous poop.
You'd rather,
come on, I mean, what the
hell? $4 a gallon for, and you know what? It doesn't pollute nearly as much. I don't think it pollutes at all.
I am on board 100%.
It makes those old engines run better because it increases the compression.
So you have this is an empathetic gesture towards old engines?
Yeah, kind of. Plus, we cannot afford a hybrid. They are just going up and up in price, and I don't think they're that good. Really.
You look like an inventor. Why don't you invent something?
The steam engine is a still. You know what? The steam engine.
Why don't you do that? Why don't you, get some tools and build a damn steam engine?
Stanley steamer.
Yeah, build a Stanley steamer.
You're laughing at that right now.
I'm not laughing.
People always laugh at the electric car and the Stanley steamer. But you know what? Steam engines are 60% efficient compared to gasoline engines, which are 25% efficient. You know what that means, Einstein?
Yeah. What?
I'm not telling you because you don't know. Look it up.
I'm telling you, the thought of you driving down the street in some weird kind of with like a large wheeled automotive looking thing with a.
See, now you're making dumb jokes.
This hissing. I'm making dumb jokes. What? Can I wear the shoes for a minute? Look, like I just see this one going, making like sounds like that, and you're like, "Hello, everybody."
That's me taking a walk.
I'm Jimmy Earl.
No, it's nothing like that. They're much more efficient. They're much more powerful, and they last like years longer than a gasoline engine because they only have about 8 to 10 moving parts. You know that? No clutch, no transmission. You have instant full power. You know
in what, the steam car?
Steam engine, instant full power. That's why in all those old movies you see a locomotive and the wheels are spinning. That's because it's got instant full power. You don't have to go through four gears to get up there.
Is Heather going to be shoveling the coal into the...
No. Look, you
what?
See there it
what?
Go again.
I'm ignorant.
Steam engines run on an infinite amount of fuel. So... Yeah, you know what that means, fella.
What heats the water, smartass?
Anything. So you can have any kind of, you can have least polluting, most efficient fuels that run it.
Like what?
And the steam is utilized much better, more efficiently than the gas because there are condensers. Condensers condense the steam, and you don't have to waste so much fuel heating up the water. This is why it's so important that we change to steam cars immediately.
Jim's a steam geek. He's a buzzkill steam geek.
Stanley steamer. You know why the Stanley steamer went out? Steam cars went out of business?
I'm just so glad you're excited.
You know why they went out of business? Because the gasoline industry spread rumors that they blew up. Boilers blew up.
Okay, let me ask you a question,
genius.
And
two, because people wanted to get into a, quote, get in and run car, meaning that the steam cars did not have electronic ignition back then.
They do now. Okay, I agree with you. I think that this is all well and good, and I think that because you're so excited about it, that you should get up off your butt and build something and make $1 million at it and change the way people look at the world.
Okay, I need like 3 weeks off to take welding class. Rent a garage.
Why don't you? What do you mean 3 weeks off?
And,
do it at night.
Do it.
You got plenty of time to take a welding class for an hour.
No, I don't.
You know, it was weird. I was in Vegas. At what point is? Have you seen people play poker with? They wear glasses. They wear hats. They wear gloves. I mean, at what point is it not bluffing and it's just hiding? There was a guy in Vegas sitting at a poker table with a welding helmet on. That's wrong, right? Isn't that too much?
Oh, man, that is so insensitive. The man had some horrible facial injury.
I don't know about that. I think you're right. I'm going to look into these steam cars. Where
steam
can
cars,
I get them?
Look it up on the internet. You can't buy. You have to buy. There are kits you can make.
Oh, well,
you can
wait a minute. Now I got to buy tools?
No. Yeah.
What?
God forbid we should become self-sufficient in our tool.
Don't be judgmental, guy, without having the goods.
Look, man, I'm just saying, hydrogen is like 50 years away, and electronic cars, they're still not, you still have to pay, what, $10,000?
You should be on a corner.
Per fuel cell, it's
on
ridiculous.
A box. You should be yelling at the air.
Hybrid cars is a friggin' myth, because it's not going to work.
So now the hybrids are bad.
Hybrids are bad, you have to.
Because you can't afford them, all of a sudden they're
bad.
Do you see how this works?
Under 40 miles an hour in traffic.
Just say, I can't afford it, which means that it must be bad.
I cannot afford it.
All right, then, and say that because of that,
it
must be bad.
People should be able to afford it for it to be useful. That's all I'm saying.
Why don't you run for a socialist candidate for president?
I would like to. Upton Sinclair was the best candidate this state's ever had for governor.
Well, get on with it then, because I'm tired of hearing you yapping.
Now,
would you facilitate some change in this state?
Now
we
got a fascist governor. Instead of a socialist, we have a fascist governor.
And that's bad. So I'm saying Jim for governor. When does that happen? Can you do that soon?
Well, I need some funds and some time off again, and I need to take a welding class.
So you need a welding class, and now you need time off and money to run for governor on the socialist ticket.
Yeah. Is that too much to ask?
Maybe you should learn how to speak Spanish. And yeah, I think that you could really change things
Spanish,
with the momentum.
I'm not a big fan of the Spanish. I'm gonna get a lot of no cards and letters, but I'm not a big fan of the Spanish language. I don't think it's the prettiest language out there.
What do you think is?
I really love German.
Really?
Yeah, it's fun.
You're
easy.
You're a man of mystery and confusion, and highfalutin ideas that are bordering on self-righteous and annoying.
Self-righteous and steam cars?
No, I like steam cars. We'll be back with David Poland.
And now he once severed his hand at a chocolate factory. Mark Maron.
Hey, that's weird. You smell like French fries.
I was just filling up my car.
Donuts.
Hey, you smell like stinky Chinese food.
Yeah, I just filled up my car.
Yeah. Like that's worse than gas? Smell like gas?
What?
Huh? Got you there. Now get on to the movie guy.
But wait, no. Gas has a spigot where you pick it up and you insert it in the hole.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas you're going to be ladling sludge behind restaurants.
Right. Oil doesn't have spigots. It has to magically appear. It gets all over your body.
Whoa, back up. So you're saying that behind the Chinese restaurant or behind the McDonald's, there can be a little pump for people like you to come by and...
You politely go into the kitchen and ask, hey, can I have your discarded oil?
And what if they say, if you clean my fryer later, clown.
They'll let you do it because it costs them money and have it taken away.
Yeah, I've heard this before, and I think it's a great idea. And it's not some weird sputtering mobile that's
steam engines do not sputter.
I'm talking about the other one, the ones that are run on French fry grease. I love the idea, and I'm behind it 100%. I'm going to take the first ride in the Jim Earl Stanley steamer. I'm going to be the first guy in there next to Heather. I'm going to talk movies now. Is that all right?
Go ahead.
I'm just being a devil's advocate. You know I support you 100% and all your stupid ideas. All right. David Poland has been on the show before, and every time he demystifies the illusion of film for me and shatters all of my childhood wonder about the movies. His site, thehotbutton.com, and the site he writes for, moviecitynews.com, are respected in the film biz for their insight and speculation. So let us speculate. Welcome back to the show, David Poland.
Hey, Mark. How you doing?
Good.
You know, there is a great documentary called The Yes Men, which is now on cable, and you can get on DVD.
Oh, yeah?
And it's about these two guys who create a fake WTO site.
Oh, I met these guys. I've interviewed them.
Yeah, they're terrific. And they do this whole bit where they go from the crapper at McDonald's and the food goes down a tube and eventually gets remade into burgers for third world countries.
Oh.
What a great idea that is. And they had this, they actually presented this at a WTO meeting.
And they infiltrated
them. And people thought it was a great idea.
Yeah, they're interesting guys. Classic pranksters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I read something on your blog that was kind of different for you. You kind of deconstructed a advertisement for a car.
Yes. Well, I'm fascinated. There's actually this whole series of car ads right now, particularly for Volkswagen, that are extremely kind of edgy and cutting edge.
The accident ones?
Well, the accident ones, which
are
done by the guy who did
awesome
ads, done by the guy who did Junebug, the director who did Junebug, Phil Morrison. You'd be surprised how many directors of independent films and documentaries are actually making a living
doing commercials. Yeah.
But the one that I wrote about was the one that was the people hanging out of their cars with bullhorns saying, I'm a fat slob trying to manipulate you.
Right, yeah.
I'm much more beautiful than you think I am.
Yeah.
My daddy didn't love me. And how this is kind of like the new vogue is the anti-hipness thing.
So they're going back to the working man's car, the Volkswagen, the people's car.
Well, I think it kind of goes with the smuggler thing that happened on South Park, where there's now this kind of attitude like, I'm better than you by being less better than you.
So people are underplaying it. So,
yeah.
And you,
being unspecial is really special.
what you took from that was that why would people aspire to be average?
Well, I mean, people, I think, generally speaking, are average, unfortunately, because it's by the nature of average.
I was just in Vegas. Don't tell me what, I mean, people, it's a sad display.
Yeah, it's a crazy place. But the idea now, I think, is that it's hip to be square, even though if you actually said that, they would laugh at you and hang Huey Lewis by his thumbs. But
And also, it seemed to me that you were getting at this idea that everybody's going for the common denominator, which is what movies do all the time, for the most part, isn't it?
Well, it's a weird thing, because it's that balance between the common denominator and exciting the audience. So
right.
You have we're in this very strange period this summer in particular where the expectations are so insane on these movies that Mission Impossible opening at $47 million is a disaster.
Yeah,
Poseidon opened at $22 million is a disaster.
Right, but we talked about that before, but the bottom line that I wanted to hit with that bottom line again with that damn phrase is that you didn't think that Cruise's behavior was going to be a liability. It seemed like it was.
I don't think it was. I think the way they sold the movie was a liability. Ultimately, they made a movie that didn't appeal to women. Tom Cruise may have a problem with women. He certainly is not quite what he was a few years ago, but he's getting older. And then the reality is you have to sell the movie.
Yeah.
Just because he's Tom Cruise and just because it's a movie doesn't mean it sells itself.
Right.
And, you know, he did Collateral, which was considered a success, but it was $110 million in America. You know, you can't just assume that people are going to show up because Tom Cruise is in a movie. $47 million opening is still a pretty significant opening.
Yeah.
And the truth is that if you look at the advertising, the campaign before that, it was all about explosions.
Right.
And Tom Cruise getting thrown against the car and all of that.
Yeah.
And we've seen a lot of that. It's not quite as cool and new as it once was.
Right.
And they had absolutely nothing to appeal to women.
Except for Tom Cruise flying around and looking like Tom Cruise, which is
well, but
enough.
In theory, that doesn't work as well as it used to be. It's an interesting
with him or in general.
I think in general, the marketplace has changed so that you're actually marketing to specific groups, and women want to see some reason why they want to go to that movie on Saturday night, and they didn't see that reason as much. I mean, $47 million is still a lot of money.
Right.
It's funny because, you know, you always think of Batman, you know, 15 years ago being $40 million for a weekend. It's a miracle.
It's huge.
And, you know, that was the biggest ever when it happened.
Right.
Now it's considered junk. It's a disaster. it's a crazy world.
And obviously it's not going to lose money, but the Poseidon
Adventure.
Well,
it may lose money.
It really?
It
how
may
could
be
it possibly
a break
lose
even.
Money?
It depends how it does overseas in the long run and not just the first couple weekends. It depends how it holds up here. That movie does $350 million worldwide, they're going to have a hard time making money on it. Because Cruise gets a big chunk of the money up front.
That's unbelievable.
He doesn't actually get an upfront fee. He now gets a percentage of the gross.
I thought they had designed the business at this point to almost protect themselves from ever losing money.
Unless you spend too much money. I mean, the thing is the irony of it is they finally got it just right so you couldn't lose money, and now they've started spending over $100 and $150 million per movie for a lot of the summer movies.
So they're still gamblers
they haven't
in the
learned.
Game.
What happens is you start to think that you need more and more, and if you add something more, it'll be better. So if you take Tom Cruise, okay, you can get an audience with Tom Cruise. Now we need a bigger explosion. Now we need a bigger event. Now we need more internationalism, whatever. Nobody knows that when you're selling the movie.
Yeah.
And the truth is the movie business is now driven by the marketing, not by the movies.
Right.
Even though critics always say, oh, there's a slump because the movies aren't as good. The truth is opening weekend and the few weekends after that, and that's all you get in theatrical anymore, are all about the marketing. It's all about the trailer.
Yeah.
So if you have enough for the trailer, if you can blow up New York, like in The Day After Tomorrow, horrible movie, unwatchable movie, really.
It was. I thought so, too.
And yet did $180 million here and did $600 million worldwide.
You know what's pathetic?
Because people
about
wanted to see New York blow up.
Yeah. You know what's pathetic about it? Am I thinking of the wrong movie? Which is the one where everything froze?
That was the Day After Tomorrow.
Okay. So it's a froze thing.
Yeah.
Right?
With Fiddler on the Roof going on the New York Public Library because they got things out of the shtetl. They had a closet in back and they're all walking around around, and Anne Hathaway is looking like she came from Anatevka.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that was the weird thing about that movie, is that movie became ultimately just a movie. Half the world dies, but this father and son reunite at the end.
Exactly.
It was ridiculous.
It was obscenely stupid movie.
Oh, my God. So let's talk
and
about...
And yet made a ton of money in 3 or 4 weeks.
Well, that's because people are fascinated with the idea of the world ending.
I thought the trend was against high-concept movies. You know.
Well, the thing is that you have to be able to beat the last high concept movie. So ultimately, it's the image of White House being blown up in Independence Day.
That was good.
It's New York being frozen over in The Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah.
It's the Twister tornado and the cow flying around.
Yeah,
it's
cars.
You can't come up with something that we haven't seen before, like the Mission Impossible ads.
Yeah.
So what? You know, it's okay, so he gets thrown against the car and a plane flies over. Who cares? You can see that on TV.
Are we ever going to come full circle to where what's appealing is really like, I guess we sort of are on some level, because it seems like in movies, that's extremely popular and there's that race. But on TV, reality shows and losers and just regular people who aren't that talented are completely fascinating.
Well, we've also lost our perspective on what success is. So if an independent film makes $50 million, that's an enormous success. The fact that it's not comparative to something like, you know, The Day After Tomorrow or to Mission Impossible or whatever, Pirates of the Caribbean, is not really sane. Our perspective on what works has become crazy.
Let's talk about The Poseidon Adventure, because that movie, when I was a kid, it stuck in my head.
Love that movie.
Yeah, you got to love that movie.
Loved it.
Now, this movie, what is it? Well, I guess there are two questions. How did it do? Not that good, right?
It did very mediocre.
Okay. Is it a mediocre movie?
No, it's worse than that. Oh, it's a bad movie. The thing is, I love Wolfgang Petersen. I think he's actually one of the best action directors out there, but they hired the wrong cast with a bad script, and it just wasn't that interesting. Ultimately, he could have made a better movie, or they could have come up with better talent. Most of the cast is really nobody you'd want to have dinner with, much less watching
a movie. Do you like Josh Lucas?
To me, Josh Lucas is great when he plays a arch villain. He's very interesting because he's really good at being evil. As a hero, he sucks.
And Kurt Russell's
terrific, but he kind of got lost in it because they have two heroes, which is a stupid concept to begin with. Then you have Richard Dreyfuss playing gay, which is amusing, except that he stops doing it after the first 2 minutes. So, you know, you establish that he's a gay man who's lost his love. He's going to jump off the side of the boat, and then he sees the wave. He runs off back to everybody. The boat capsizes, and now he's going to find, you know, meaning in life, but he never does because they're too busy going into some other character.
How's the wave?
The wave, it looks a lot like The Perfect Storm, except with a bigger boat underneath of it. It really, that's exactly the kind of thing about high concept, is that the wave and the boat turning over and all that, not enough.
Right.
We saw The Perfect Storm. We saw Titanic. It looks good. It's better than it was then, but so what?
You know what I love is giant fish of any kind.
Like squids would be fabulous.
Giant squids, huge sharks, just huge dinosaur-like fish.
Well, there's a great part in the movie, which made me think of old Irwin Allen movies, where one of the characters gets hit in the head with something and starts bleeding out into the water. And I thought, sharks are coming!
Here we go!
Great! Sharks are in the boat!
No sharks?
Of course, sharks can't get into the boat, but it would have been they should have done it anyway, because it would have been fun.
Or maybe those wolves from The Day After Tomorrow.
It has so no sense of humor about itself. That's the thing. Is like the Poseidon Adventure, the original one, was pathos, but it was also great joy and funny.
Yeah.
There was a funny edge to it, and there was a kitsch to it.
And Shelley Winters made it. She swam.
Gene Hackman.
Yeah,
people
Gene
forget
Hackman.
That Gene Hackman
jumped on that valve,
hanging from that thing. The priest with the
with
the hot
turtleneck.
Priest with the turtleneck.
Yeah,
hanging from the valve.
And what was it? Dick? Who was it? Red Buttons.
Red Buttons.
Yeah.
How can you make a movie that after you have Red Buttons and Ernest Borgnine and Shelley Winters in a movie together? How can you have a movie that's boring?
How can
you not hire people who are that funny?
Is Ernest Borgnine still alive?
He is.
Yeah. Oh, where the hell has he been?
He's hanging around with his wife makes their money now.
Right.
His wife has a line of cosmetics.
Yeah. So now let's just briefly talk about what the hell are they thinking when they make a remake of a movie like that? I mean, I don't understand what the idea is. I mean, is the same idea as a sequel? I mean, are they tapping in our common memory of it? I mean, how do they think they're going to make money on
it? Well, the theory is that you have a built-in recognition of the material.
Yeah.
So as a marketing, you have an advantage. However, what's becoming apparent to a lot of people is you have a marketing disadvantage also, because everybody's comparing it to their experience of the old movie, and it doesn't necessarily match up.
When they were 7.
Well, that's the thing. All the media is in their 40s and 50s,
so
they have a different attitude than the kids. So that's why you see so many movies not screening for critics.
Right.
Because why should they show a movie to critics that is really not for them?
Right.
Not really meant for a 40-year-old. It's meant for a 15-year-old. So why bother doing it? And the critics get cranky about it, and they have to go on Friday afternoon and pay money and, and, you know, do it in a deadline and all of that stuff. But it's really – there are all these variables in the business now, and remaking Poseidon. I love the idea of remaking Poseidon Adventure. I just thought they should have found another reason to do it.
Maybe
there has to be a reason why you make the remake.
Right.
So this case, it could have been a thing where you really could have had a sense of the space of the boat, and there could have been two or three groups trying to get up at the same time, and they eventually connect, and you're watching them, and you have a sense of the entire boat, because you can do that technically.
Oh, there was that great
scene,
and
couldn't.
I just remembered it with the people going the wrong way, and Captain going, "You're going the wrong way!"
Yeah.
And they were going, ah, so they're doomed. You just see them go down the hall. All right, so when we come back, we'll finish with David Poe, and then figure out what we should see.
I need to know. I need to go to the movies. So hang out with us. We'll be back.
Stay tuned for 3 minutes of crap. That's right. Mark Maron's Short Order News is coming up next.
Now he's recalling his lens solution. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. We're here with David Poland, hotbutton.com, moviecitynews.com, talking about Vegas on the break, that how Misha and I went down to the original downtown. I think we're at the Golden Nugget, which has been redone, and they have enclosed downtown a little bit to try and make it a little more unified because it is kind of sleazy. But
Did you go out and watch the movie on the roof?
No.
See, that's kind of cool.
I mean, there's a lot of things I didn't do, but I just found that gambling, like, downtown had a little more integrity. The gaming seemed a little more honest. The clientele, it really seemed like people that were there to enjoy the sport of it as opposed to sort of, tourist suckers up at the Strip.
Where the locals hang out now.
Yeah.
There are a couple hotels, a couple big hotels on the other side of the freeway there.
Uh-huh.
And then there's downtown. And it feels like real people. It feels like people
are actually... That's exactly right. And it was a little more comfortable, and you had a little more of a relationship with the dealer as they sympathize with you, giving them money after more money and more money.
The people going to the pawn shop with their teeth. And getting an extra few bucks for that gold tooth and back and then trying to get it back the next night.
Oh, man. I can understand it, but it is so not worth the buzz to me. I was much more of a drugs guy. The gambling thing is just paralyzing.
Well, the thing is, if you go to a place, some of these places, you go in the back room and essentially you're hanging out at a party that could be in any city in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So why does it have to be Vegas? There's really no upside. There's really nothing happening there.
That's true.
It's special. And then if you go outside, it's hot and it's wet or it's dry or it's whatever. Yeah. And it's a bunch of people in shorts and 150 pounds too much weight.
Yeah, it's a little
gruesome.
It's a bit sad. So let's talk. What movie do I need to see? I have to watch the rest of this Peaceful Warrior movie because I'm going to be interviewing.
I've managed to not see the Peaceful Warrior, even though I should. I know I should.
I don't know.
And yet I haven't. I'm going to see An Inconvenient Truth tomorrow night.
Okay.
Apparently we're going to get more hype about that than any other movie in the history of mankind. It's going to be like the Mission Impossible of environmental doctor dramas.
Okay, I'm going to see that. What about big movies? Anything?
Big movies? You might want to stay home for a while.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, there's hope for X-Men 3, but it's still X-Men 3 and Brett Ratner and not a great piece of directing. Really, the next thing that people are kind of looking forward to is, in terms of good is people are hopeful about The Breakup.
Okay. Oh,
which
really?
Is coming in a few weeks.
It's going to be cute and funny.
It should be cute and funny. We're hoping it's cute and funny. But the big movie, the only real big movie of the summer is Pirates of the Caribbean. And, of course, Da Vinci Code is coming next week, which
Okay.
Obsessed with, and yet I don't see quite the numbers that some people see.
Did you watch it? Did you see it yet?
I'm seeing it Wednesday.
Oh, man. We should have.
Because it's opening in Cannes, and they're showing it here and in New York and in Europe and everywhere at the same time.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us, David Poland. It's great to see you.
Great to see you.
Go to the website, markmaron.com, link to his websites. Right now, a lot happened in the world. We don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed, so let's do the second edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. In his speech to the nation tonight, President Bush proposed using thousands of National Guard troops to patrol the Mexican border. If the troops become too thin, Bush plans on hiring thousands of illegal immigrants to protect our border from thousands of illegal immigrants. During his graduation speech at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, Senator John McCain essentially apologized for denouncing the Christian fundamentalists as evil 6 years ago. McCain later passed out T-shirts to the graduates that read, "John McCain, kissing ass and taking names." All right. A woman in Idaho discovered a heart-shaped potato. The woman is currently storing the potato in a cupboard right next to her vagina-shaped jicama.
I was going to write vagina-shaped kumquat. But
what do you got to take credit for all your jokes for? Why don't you just let it go? Everyone knows that you write some of the jokes, Jim. What is it with this celebration?
I was just proud of the jicama thing.
Man, you're just tragic.
the jicama.
Ugh, can't even behave like a regular writer.
I didn't want to use kumquat.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's overused, but it is a funny word.
I'm not going to even do your jokes anymore because I'm tired of this weird
this
entitlement you have
it
around
you know
being
why?
A writer.
I have self-image. I have self-image.
You have self-image?
That means that
you mean self-esteem? You have self-esteem?
Oh, man, now you're bringing me down.
Yeah, you have self-esteem,
I screwed that
Jim?
Up. Fine. Great, go ahead, do that. I try to do something for the environment with the oil cars and the donut car.
Yeah,
thing.
You're really making points, man.
Steam
you're,
cars.
And, you know, you screwed with my head on Friday when you read that thing on the blog about me and my wife, Mishnah, and you said it was about me and you, and it turns out it wasn't about you and me, and you you basically earled everybody involved. You know, it's yeah. really, you're like...
You know what? I'm in control.
Uh-huh.
I'm in control.
All right.
Hey, Mark Maron Show. Hey, tomorrow we're going to have some guests. I'm going to talk to somebody about something else.
Yeah, attaboy.
And then I'm going to come in and yell.
David Pollan's still sitting here being polite.
I know.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask him about any new releases of, like, you know, old
go
stuff.
Ahead,
like,
go
ahead. You know, like Harold Lloyd. Harold Lloyd had a great package. Coming out.
I sure he had a great package.
And a great
I feel like I'm watching Stephen Curry.
And a great a box set, too. Box set.
That was Mrs.
Harold Lloyd's package. That should be the name
Lloyd's
of
package
that's
right. and the box
name,
set.
Name of a band.
But what about
Harold Lloyd's package?
That was like safety last.
And it, yeah.
See the outtakes of what he was really hanging from that clock with.
You know, you're talking about, you know, the new re-release sequels and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Never mind. I have nothing to say. You know what? I'm fed up with you. I'm just fed up with you.
Already? You know, it's Monday. How the hell could you be fed up with you?
You're an energy sucker. That's what you are. You know?
I'm an energy sucker.
Energy sucker.
I'm an energy sucker?
Absolutely.
Oh, come on now.
You know, I come in here, I'm full of life, I'm loving it, and all of a sudden, ugh.
I did that?
Yeah.
Oh, so the tables have turned one day?
You know that scene
oh
my God, Spinal Tap where it goes up to 11? Well, you go down to -4.
What,
that's what it's
me?
About.
Do you know what it's like to walk into the studio and see you eating your sad donut? Do you know what it's like? It's like the donut of sadness.
Yeah, I'm contributing the more oil for the oil car.
I think we should clear something up. I was not negative today, and I think we had a good time. And you're just projecting. I mean, I think this was fine. I just think you're now starting trouble just for the sake of starting trouble.
But he's the fuzz.
Yeah, exactly.
He's eating a donut.
You're the fuzz, man. The okay, fuzz.
Come on,
hey, look, Lewis Black, Nancy Northrup. From Center for Reproductive Rights, Tom Reynolds with the sad song, Jack Bulware. Good night, sheeple. Good night, Jim. It's going to be fine. Was that 8 hours long?